Well, welcome to Monday morning, Bio-231 class. It's June 29th, Monday. Let's take a look at the schedule, see where we are. So the 29th, Monday, we're going to get into appendicular skeleton. That's chapter 8. And then last time we did have a practicum. They're graded. They're online. You can look at them in lab today if you want to. Go over them. And what else? Don't forget, Thursday, there's no class. It's part of 4th of July holidays. So you have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday off from coming to campus. But we do have class a week from today, and we're going to start muscles then. Okay, muscles of the body. Then your next test is 1.5 weeks away, exam number 2, right? Covering chapters 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. Yep, all those right there, about 1.5 weeks away, something like that. Okay, don't forget, in a regular semester, it would be 3 weeks away. But since we're going twice as fast as regular semester, it's about 1.5 weeks. That's going to be on a Wednesday, and then right afterwards, and that Thursday is your second practicum, and then after July 9th, the class is half over at that point in time. So keep your study time going, keep your attitude good. I know it's moving fast, but that just means it's going to be over soon. Okay, so, just keep a good attitude. And I'll try to work with people, take a look at your study plan and all that kind of stuff. Make sure that you're putting the time in so that you can pass the class with a decent grade. The practicums were a whole lot better than that first exam. I'm happy to see that. And I'm sure you're looking forward to looking them over a little bit later today. All right, so we were talking about axial skeleton last time. Just have to finish up a couple little details, and then we're going to move into appendicular skeleton, which is chapter 8. Are there any questions on the schedule at all? I think we're all there pretty much. I have all the lectures online. I'm still putting them online, but probably I want to know if anybody is looking at those lectures online. If nobody's looking at them, I probably won't put them up there, but if you think you might get around to it, I'm happy to keep putting them there. Does anybody ever look at those lectures online? Yeah? Okay, good. And I'm happy to do that. And you can fill in your notes. When you listen to the lectures again, what do you use them for? Just to listen to or review concepts or fill in your notes or review? Just kind of go over what we did in class a little bit? Yeah, because it's happening fast. All right. In lab, tell your study group or your lab partners what you're doing to study and tell them what helps you. Not everything works for everybody, but if you find a technique that really helps you learn the material, be sure to tell your lab partners, okay? Okay. All right, so axial skeleton. Remember, all the bones in the body we can break into two main categories. And the two main categories, what are the two main categories that we can break all the bones down into? Yeah, axial and appendicular skeleton. Axial, if you recall, includes the skull, the vertebral column, which we've kind of gone over already, and then the ribs and the sternum. Right, ribs and sternum are some armor plating that protects the internal organs of the thorax, like the heart, lungs, great blood vessels. Right, and the vertebral column that I see right here is armor plating for the spinal cord. And then the skull right here is armor plating for the brain. So that's pretty much what the axial skeleton is all about. Appendicular then attaches to the axial skeleton. Axial skeleton is more medially located compared to the appendicular skeleton. All right, so how many cervical vertebrae do we have? How many cervical? Yeah, remember, when do you have breakfast? 7 a.m. How many thoracic vertebrae do you have? You got 12, right? Because you have lunch at noon. And then how many lumbar vertebrae? They have 5, okay. Because that's typically when people might think they have supper. All right, so here I see a vertebral body. Here I see a vertebral body. I see another vertebral body. And then I see a transverse process peeking out here, a transverse process peeking out there. And I see another transverse process peeking out over here. Can you kind of picture this transverse process? Okay. Now forget that this label is here. Forget this L1 is right there. And Let's count the number of ribs that we have. And let's review. How many thoracic vertebrae are there? Yeah, there are 12. All right, so if you count these ribs, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. There's 12 of them. So it's not by coincidence that there are 12 pairs of ribs and 12 vertebrae. They, by definition, a thoracic vertebrae has to have ribs attached to it. If it doesn't have a rib attached to it, it can't be a thoracic vertebrae. So here is the 12th rib. So this is, could anybody tell me what vertebrae that I have the cursor on right now? Yeah, which 12? You would want to say T12 or thoracic 12, right? That's sort of silly to say that because here's a rib. Everybody should know that, but it's okay if you say that, right? So thoracic 12. And then the vertebrae right below it has to be which one? L1, lumbar number 1, okay? So remember, these things sticking out here and here are transverse processes. That's not a rib. All right, so rib number 1 looks a whole lot different when we get to lab compared to all the remainder of these ribs. And we do like to group these ribs. We see that the posterior part is attached to a vertebrae. Anterior part is attached to the sternum. And so maybe let's go over some parts of the sternum. It has three main parts. The most superior part is called the manubrium. Then this bigger one just down below it is the body of the sternum. And then in us, this little nubbin right here, the xiphoid process, has already ossified. It looks like cartilage in this particular illustration, but in all of us, I'm sure it has turned to bone already, right? During development, it is cartilage. So there are joints that fuse between all of these different parts of the sternum. And this part right here, when you get to lab, you'll notice that this joint kind of puckers out a little bit, and it forms a little bit of an angle, and it's a prominent feature on the surface of the sternum. And so we're going to call this the sternal angle. And this joint, how would we talk about this joint between the manubrium and the body? All right, remember, we can combine terms by putting an O between them, so we would call this manubrio-sternal joint, manubrio-sternal joint. And this would be the xiphosternal joint right here, xiphoid process. Now, who's run into the xiphoid process before, ever? Maybe even before studying anatomy. Anybody ever learn about the xiphoid process? Yeah, what do you know about that xiphoid process? And in what respect? Okay, I'm thinking about people that have some training that can actually help somebody's heart beat when that person's heart doesn't beat on its own anymore. Yeah. Ah, yeah, for CPR. Why is it good to know something about the xiphoid process for CPR? Yeah, because it can snap off. This is a pretty weak joint. And like I said, in our population, in adults, the xiphoid process is a bone, and when it snaps off, it has some really sharp edges, and so it can lacerate tissues that are around it, right? And even since in CPR, you'll be doing chest compressions, you'll be pushing pretty forcefully on the body of the sternum, okay? So you're going to be pressing forcefully, and if you press on the xiphoid process and you're pushing really hard, then it can move even into deeper layers. It can even move down into the pericardium and lacerate the heart, or it can lacerate a lung, or even another organ. Yeah. You know, you probably wouldn't notice it, because when you're doing CPR on somebody, you're really not all that observant for little fine details like that. You're just really trying to keep that person alive, and I would guess there's just way too excitement and anxiety to notice a small little thing like that, right? But so there's a way to know, and so that's important. Yeah, you won't be able to hear a snap necessarily or feel a snap, but how can you prevent that? Well, the other organ, when this thing breaks off, that could be lacerated is a liver, which is right over here, right? And so if it breaks off and it starts lacerating other organs, then you're not really helping a person, you're making them worse, right? So you really want to know about that. So to prevent that from breaking off, what's a good way to prevent that from happening in the first place? Anybody CPR trained in here? Yeah. How do you prevent that from breaking off in the first place? Okay. Well, you just feel where it is. We call that palpation, right? You use some fingertips, and you can feel that xiphoid process on you. And enough, sometimes it actually sticks out anterior a little bit. You can palpate it. And then use like maybe three fingers. And then make sure when you do chest compressions, it's at least three fingers above where that xiphoid process is. All right, so just by, we call that surface anatomy, right? So it is nice to know some surface anatomy so that we can actually help some people. Usually my classes are really big in anatomy, sometimes 100, 120 students. And when I ask this question, there's, most of the time, there's somebody in the room that can raise their hand, right? And so here's the question. Has anybody ever saved anybody's life by doing CPR in here? Raise your hand. Anybody? One person, two people, oh, even in a really small room like that. Yeah, so that's amazing. That's amazing. So it's really good training, and I wish all my students would know CPR, because you just never know, right, how, when you can save somebody's life. We'll talk about CPR in other parts of the class too, but in terms of the skeletal system, that's an important feature. All right, so we said that there are 12 ribs, and we do classify them. The superior seven, okay, attach directly to the sternum via this costal cartilage. All right, so here is the end of a rib, and then there's some costal cartilage that moves over to the sternum. All the ribs that attach directly to the sternum via this cartilage is what we call a true rib. True rib has that cartilage going over there. So there are some false ribs, and I see some false ribs, and you might wonder, gee whiz, what's a false rib? Well, if we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, let's look at number 7. Here's that costal cartilage, and can you see it moving directly to the body of the sternum? Here's that little piece right here. And then rib number 8, which is down below it, I see some of that costal cartilage, but look, it doesn't make it all the way over to the sternum. It just attaches to the cartilage of rib number 7, right? It has an indirect attachment. So that's what we call a false rib. False rib is any kind of rib that does not directly attach to the sternum. So that includes, right? So that includes which one? Here's 8, 9, 10, and let's look at 11 and 12. Are 11 and 12 false ribs? Okay, 11 and 12 false ribs. Remember, we said a true rib has to attach directly to the sternum. So does 11 and 12 attach directly to the sternum? And if you look at that, you see, oh, well, they don't attach directly to the sternum. So 11 and 12 are false ribs as well. But what else can you tell me about these 11 and 12, ribs 11 and 12? There's still something different compared to number 10, which is where I have the cursor right now. 11 and 12, do you see any cartilage on 11 and 12? No costal cartilage. So indeed, these are false ribs, but because they don't even have any cartilage on them, we call these floating ribs. All right, so these floating ribs are false, okay? They're not true ribs because they don't attach, all right? But 8 through 10, right, are not floating ribs, they're just false ribs. So it is possible to be a floating rib, okay, because it doesn't have any cartilage right there. All right, so that's for ribs. We want to look at some details of ribs. This is going to be really nice to look at in lab. This enlarged area of a rib, this is what attaches to a thoracic vertebrae. This enlarged region at an end of a bone, typically we like to call that a head. So here is the head of the rib, and then here's a little bit of a narrowing before we get to this prominent area here that's a little bit thicker, and this is a rough raised area, so this is for attachment of muscles and ligaments, right, that attach to this rib. So it's a little bit stronger and thicker. This narrow part, and that's a tubercle, we call this a tubercle, all right, so between the head and this tubercle, this is what we call the neck, and a lot of bones have necks. Right, it's just a narrowing between a head and some other bony prominence, usually a process that is distal. Right, and we're going to see that the rib courses anteriorly and then moves across the front of a person. So here's what we call the costal angle, and then here's the shaft, and then here is the costal junction with the cartilage that goes to the sternum, for instance. And then here is a really good example of a long, narrow depression. And take a look at your notes. What can we call a long, narrow depression on a bone? It's going to be on the surface of the bone. It could have two different names. One of them is on the slide, and it's typically how most people talk about it. It's called a costal groove. Can you see this little groove right here? All right, so this is a fossa. What's the function of a fossa? A fossa, remember, is like a bowl. Here's a bowl, but it's long and narrow. All right, if it was more circular, what's the function of a fossa? I think of a foramen as a passageway moving through a bone. Okay, a fossa is like a bowl. It holds something. All right, so this particular one is long and narrow. We call that a groove. So there's probably blood vessels that move right through this area on this bone, and this bone protects the blood vessels from being lacerated, and nerve goes right through here too, right? Because blood vessels are long and narrow, nerves are long and narrow, and they fit very nicely in this costal groove. All right, so when we look at this rib, the orientation is really nice. This is about how it would be in your body. Is this costal groove, how would you tell me where is this costal groove? Oh, another name for costal groove could be a costal sulcus. Sulcus and groove are the same thing in anatomy. Where would you tell people to look for this costal groove? We're just going to practice some directional terms. Where is this costal groove at on this rib? Okay, I see one way to talk about it pretty easily. Is it superior or inferior? Yeah, it's inferior. It's on the inferior aspect of the rib, right? It's also on the interior side, right? So it's the more medial side, not the lateral side of this bone. And it's near the angle, right? But I think what I really want you to see that it's on the inferior part, not the superior part of a rib. And that's how you're going to find it when you look at some ribs in lab. Okay. So I think that's everything. I'm going to show you this when we get into lab, how a rib articulates with some thoracic vertebrae. Oh, here's that little costal groove right here once again. All right, so I'll show you that. Okay, anybody have a question regarding anything on the axial skeleton? Axial skeleton, let's see, you've been a lecture exam on skull. Is that right? Like you've had a lecture exam on skull? No, you've had a practicum on skull, okay? But the lecture exam on skull is still coming up, right? So everything in the axial skeleton chapter, including the skull. You know what? There is one thing in lab. Ah, here, I just remember this. Here are some soft spots. Here is a fetal skull, and maybe you could even think of this as a neonate skull. Neonate is what? A freshly, newly born baby. Right, and I can see some bones of the cranium, like frontal bone, parietal, occipital, temporal bone. And you can see that the sutures have not ossified completely, so there's still some little membranes between these bones, but there are some regions that have still an extensive membrane, right, have not completely ossified. Does anybody remember what kind of ossification is taking place within these membranes of the skull, these flat bones of the skull? What do we call that one? Remember, there's two kinds. This is one kind. It's called intramembranous ossification, intramembranous. It happens with flat bones, and here we see these flat bones of the skull, and kind of strangely, the clavicle, which is not a flat bone, intramembranous ossification. All the rest of the bones in your body ossify by a process called endochondrial. What does chondro mean once again? Chondro? Chondrocyte, chondrosis would be cartilage, yeah, cartilage, right? Osteo would be bone. All right, so here are those soft spots, right? And remember, these membranes are not nearly as strong as these bony plates that protect the skull. And these things we call fontanelles. There are four important fontanelles that you should know about in this class. And I'll pull some fetal skulls out for you to look at in lab. Just remember, I haven't done that yet. So here is, somebody's nose would be right about where I have the cursor right now. I don't see it. So that's the anterior part of the skull. So this is what we call the anterior fontanelle, pretty much at the junction of the two frontal bones and the two parietal bones, right smack on midline. And then between the parietals and the occipital, here's the posterior fontanelle. So anterior, posterior, right on midline. Then there's two more that you can see laterally. Where the sphenoid is going to completely ossify, we have the sphenoidal fontanelle. And then back down over here by the mastoid process is the mastoid fontanelle. You could even call that the mastoidal fontanelle if you wanted to. And on this particular slide, I see a little bit of an archaic spelling for fontanelle with two L's and two E's. Fontanelle can also be spelled just N-E-L. You don't necessarily have to have the L-E on the end of it. All right. Okay, but if you want, if you appreciate a little history, you could go ahead and put that L-E at the end of that word. Okay, and I think maybe last time I did mention, how long do these fontanelles exist in a person? Yeah, 2 years. It's amazing. And the reason why that is because the nervous system of the neonate grows so rapidly that the skull has to still keep expanding, right? And bone can't keep up with the expansion of the brain inside the cranium right here. So these membranes still have to be there for a couple of years that allows for the stretching of the cranium and growth of the brain. All right, so now that's it for axial skeleton, unless I see a hand. Anybody have a hand question? Okay. All right, so I'm going to put this away, move on to appendicular skeleton. What happened to appendicular skeleton? Here it is right here. All right, so the text slides, the lecture notes are not extensive, but I have a lot of pictures to show you. And as a matter of fact, before I get to appendicular skeleton, actually let me go back to axial skeleton. All right, just a little bit right here. Okay, so here, this slide shows you the difference between axial and appendicular skeleton once again, right? And remember, axial skull, vertebral column, and rib cage, all the other bones that belong to the upper appendage and lower appendage belong to the appendicular skeleton, plus a couple other bones that act as a transition between the axial skeleton and the appendicular skeleton. So here is the bone in the arm, that's the humerus, so that's the most proximal part of the upper appendage. The way that it attaches to the axial skeleton is via a couple other bones that we call a girdle. The bones that make up the pectoral girdle are the clavicle and the scapula, and technically they're part of the appendicular skeleton, not axial skeleton. We call it a girdle because it completely surrounds the upper part of the thorax. Right? So to girdle something is to completely surround something. Like a piece of clothing that's a girdle is what? It completely surrounds like your pelvic region. Right? To girdle a tree means to cut the bark away completely around the tree. That's one way of actually killing a tree, right? Is to girdle a tree, take the bark off so that it desiccates all the way through. All right, so a girdle attaches an appendage to the axial skeleton. Pectoral girdle is clavicle and scapula. And there's also a girdle that attaches the lower appendage to the axial skeleton. And I can see it right here, the pelvic bones. All right, and typically we call one on one side an os coxae. We're going to look at a hip bone or an os coxae. You got two. You got a left one over here and a right one here. That's a girdle. Because it surrounds the pelvic cavity, we call that the pelvic girdle. So there are two girdles, pectoral and pelvic, and you can see that the pelvic girdle completely surrounds the pelvic cavity. Right, we're going to look at a pelvic bone attached to a sacrum, and so it's going to kind of look in lab as if the sacrum, right, and pelvic bones or os coxae form part of the appendicular skeleton, but remember, the sacrum is part of which skeleton, axial or appendicular? Here I see the sacrum, which is what you have to know for the quiz tomorrow in lab. Yeah, the sacrum right here, what color is it? Is it the same color as the skull? Same color? Which means it belongs to the same part of the skeleton as the skull, which is the axial skeleton. And remember, that makes perfect sense to me because the sacrum is really a part of the vertebral column, right? So anything in the vertebral column, including this little coccyx right here, anything in the vertebral column is part of the axial skeleton and not appendicular skeleton. Okay, that's what I wanted to show you. So we're going to start looking at appendicular by looking at the pectoral girdle, the two bones that make up the pectoral girdle. Where's this? Here's a nice zoomed-in region. All right, so here I see all these bones of the axial skeleton, and then we have the two bones that make up the pectoral girdle, the clavicle. What's a common name? You've called the clavicle something before, I'm sure. Collarbone, yeah, it's a collarbone. And it's kind of flat right here. Oh, maybe that's why. You know, at this aspect it does look flat, so I'm kind of thinking intramembranous ossification. Even though it's a long bone, it's still kind of flat in one direction. And here is the scapula. Scapula is in the back, right, posterior. So when we're looking at the scapula right here, we're looking at the anterior side, not the posterior side. So we're looking all the way through the thorax. Then here is a bone in the arm, that's the humerus. All right, so the girdle is the clavicle and scapula. And it's tightly wedged in between this part of the scapula, which is called the acromion process. That's the part of your shoulder that you can touch. That's the superiormost part, lateral part of the shoulder that you can palpate. Right? It's tightly wedged between, here's that acromion process on the scapula. And what bone is this over here? Medially? What is that? Part of the sternum? It is? Yeah, it's the manubrium, right? So it's tightly wedged between these two bones. Your manubrium doesn't move very much. Scapula moves a little bit, but not too much. And a lot of times when you receive a bump on the shoulder, right, a nice wrap, medial wrap on the shoulder, this clavicle here likes to fracture because it has no place to go, right? So if you fall down or you get a bicycle accident or something like that, this clavicle can actually break, and it happens a lot. So let's look at the two ends. We see that the clavicle kind of looks like an S, and the two ends look very similar. The sternal end, which is what the medial end over here, kind of flares out. It gets wider from anterior to posterior. And here is the acromial end, which attaches to the acromion process. And again, it kind of gets wider as it moves away from the shaft of the clavicle. So if you look at this aspect, which is a superior view, we're looking down on top of the clavicle, both ends kind of look the same. And this is a really good illustration of why you cannot just use pictures of bones or any anatomical feature to really understand what these things look like in real life, right? Because if you look at it in this direction, these two ends look identical to each other, right? And even if you look from the inferior, looking up into the bone, both ends kind of flare open. Once again, they look very, very similar. But in lab, right, when you look at it, you're going to see that the sternal end looks like the opening of a trumpet or clarinet or something. It flares open in all three directions, so it looks kind of like a circle. But the flared end on the acromial side is really flat. All right, so if you look at it on edge, it looks really flat, and the sternal end is going to look like the opening of a trumpet. So it's really easy to tell the difference between these two ends, and you just have to pay attention to it when you get to lab. And then you can go ahead and use the pictures as a review because you really know what it looks like. Okay, there are some really important blood vessels. There's a really important artery. There's a really important vein that move right underneath the clavicle. And now you know the name of some vascular anatomy too. Can you take a guess at what the name of those blood vessels are that go right underneath, just deep to the clavicle? That would be the subclavian artery, subclavian vein, very big arteries, right? And we said that this clavicle fractures pretty easily, right, and commonly. And a fractured bone is very sharp. Those blood vessels could be lacerated, and that would cause a massive hemorrhage, right? So people usually don't die of hemorrhage when a clavicle breaks. It's usually not, well, it's painful, but it's usually not too dangerous. And that's because of the shape of this clavicle right here. When it breaks, it always breaks out anteriorly, right? And so it breaks to the surface of your body just because of the way it's shaped. It doesn't break inferiorly or posteriorly, because if it did, it would lacerate those blood vessels and nerves in that direction, right? So that's one of the reasons why it kind of has that shape. It's been selected for on evolution, because everybody that had a different shaped clavicle probably died of massive hemorrhages when, right, they would break their clavicle. All right, so that's part of a girdle. What part of the, what girdle does the clavicle belong to? Anybody remember what girdle? Yeah, shoulder girdle. And that region of the upper thorax is what we call the pectoral region, right? So it's the pectoral girdle. All right, so that's a clavicle. Next bone that helps make the pectoral girdle is the scapula. You're going to see that it's a little bit more complicated looking, but once you see it in lab, it's not going to be too difficult to appreciate. All right, so here is, we're looking right through the skeleton, so here's the anterior side of the scapula. This region right here goes right down the vertebral column. So where is the vertebral column located in you, medial or lateral vertebral column? Medial, yeah, it goes right down the middle of your back. So here is the medial border, right, medial border. That's one good way to tell something about the scapula. And then here is a depression. Sometimes we call this the glenoid fossa, and a fossa holds something. What's held in position right here is the humerus, the first bone in your upper appendage. Attaches right here in the glenoid fossa, glenoid cavity. So what direction or what area of the scapula do we find this glenoid cavity? Would you say medial or lateral? Lateral, because that's where your arm is attached, right? Your arm isn't attached over here on midline, it's attached laterally. So the glenoid cavity is a really good landmark to understand what's lateral on the scapula. And this border here, really long border, the medial border. All right. And then the lateral border down below the glenoid cavity. Here's an inferior angle, superior angle. Ah, now I can see the superior border as well. Kind of looks like a triangle. And a good way to appreciate this bone, pick one up in lab and turn it around and put it on your body the way it belongs. And it's going to feel really awkward if you put it on your body in the wrong orientation. And if you get the orientation just right, it's going to fit perfectly and you're just going to know, okay, ah, this is how it goes. And then you'll be able to picture in your mind what's medial and lateral and what's superior, inferior, anterior, and posterior. So the anterior side of the scapula has this big depression. Right? What do we call a depression in anatomy once again? That is a fossa. And the function of a fossa is for holding something. And what's held in this region is a big muscle that goes across the shoulder, helps work on your arm, helps position your arm. Right? This fossa on the anterior side is called the subscapular fossa. Because if we go from your back, right, this is deep compared to your back. So subscapular, this is underneath the scapula, even though it's on the anterior side. So now you know the name of this muscle. Right here. If this is the subscapular fossa, the muscle in this region is called the subscapularis. Right? So again, when you know bones, when you learn bones, you'll learn about so much other kinds of important anatomy. Right? So really pay attention to your bones. So here is the where the subscapularis would be deep, okay, with respect to the scapula. We got this glenoid. Then I see some big bony prominences coming off this this lateral angle right here. What do we call a big bony prominence? And we're going to see that these are rough surfaces. What's a general name for a raised area on a bone that's rough? And we also want to know the function. Generally, it's called a process, right? A raised area on a bone is a process. What's the function of a process? Process for muscle attachment. Yeah, you just want to think muscle attachment right away. It could be attachment for ligaments. Okay, but muscle attachment is a good thing to remember. So here is that acromion process, the most lateral and superior part, sticking way up. And then here is the coracoid process, not to be confused with the coronoid process on the mandible. Okay. All right, so that's a nice anterior view. Posterior view, again, this long border right here goes up against your vertebral column, so that is the medial border. Here is that glenoid fossa. So here's got to be the lateral border, right? And then the inferior, superior angles. Here's that coracoid process sticking out above the glenoid fossa. And then here is that huge, big, bony prominence called the acromion process. And you can see that it looks rough, right? And the acromion process is right on the end of this part of the scapula. It sticks way out. And again, this is a process for muscle attachment, but it's called the spine of the scapula. And I'm sure everybody's kind of familiar with the spine of your scapula because you can actually palpate it very easily, right? It's that bone that's sticking out on the back of your shoulder. What's a common name for scapula? I almost used it right now. Shoulder blade, right? Shoulder blade. And so the spine right there is really easy to palpate on your shoulder blade. All right, so that means that there is a depression superior to the spine and inferior. So there's two depressions on the scapula, which, and remember, this is the posterior side of the bone. And the fossa that is superior to the spine is called the supraspinous fossa. The one that's below is the infraspinous. Remember the supraorbital foramen and infraorbital foramen when we looked at the skull? Use that same nomenclature right here. And what is really cool is now you know the name of two more muscles. The muscle in the supraspinous fossa is called the supraspinatus. The muscle in the infraspinous fossa is the infraspinatus. And you don't have to know that for this particular chapter, but in chapter 11, which is before the next exam, you do have to know that. So this is where they would be. So that's pretty much it for the scapula, and now I would like for you to count how many fossa do you find on a scapula. I see two right here. How many total are there? Take a look at your book, or maybe you can recall just from lecture. How many fossa did we talk about? So I see one and two. All right, what about the posterior side? Here's another one. Here's three. Is that all? Ah, what about the glenoid fossa? So there are four altogether that you should be able to see, right? Four different fossa. If we look at this view, right, we can see all four. Here's the supraspinous fossa, infraspinous fossa here. Here's the subscapular fossa, and then here is the glenoid fossa. I can see all four fossa. Okay. So supraspinatus, infraspinatus, subscapular, these are all for holding muscles, but the glenoid fossa is not for holding a muscle. It holds, does anybody remember what this holds? This holds the first part, the most proximal part of the humerus, and it just so happens that that proximal part is what we call the head of the humerus. Just like the rib had a head, the humerus has a head as well. All right, so that's scapula. So that takes us to the humerus. Right. So here is this large area on the proximal part of the humerus. That's what we call the head. Right. Then there's some big prominent features that are rough, and these are for muscle attachment. So they're processes, but they're special. They have a special name. They're called tubercles. One is big, one is small. And the small one is called the lesser. The bigger one, which is lateral, is the greater tubercle. And then I see a long depression. What do we call a long depression in a bone once again? It could have two names. It could be called a groove, or it could be called a sulcus. And this one right here goes by either one. In the book we see right here on this slide, sulcus. And it goes right between the tubercles, so we call this one the intertubercular groove or sulcus. And a really important muscle, a tendon of a muscle, goes right through here, part of the biceps brachii. Goes right through here. All right, so that's the proximal part of the bone. What do we call an end of a bone once again? Won't be tested in lecture, but you do have to know this. It was on the last test, I'm sure. What do we call the ends of a long bone? I heard it. Epiphysis, right? Epiphysis. What do we call the middle part of a long bone or the shaft? You could call it shaft, but it's got another name called the diaphysis. All right, so here is a process mid-diaphysis, and it's going to be lateral once again, and it's going to be rough. So here's a rough process mid-diaphysis. What's the function of this process right here? It's called a tuberosity. This process is a tuberosity. What's the purpose of this tuberosity right here? you're just going to want to say, just think immediately, muscle attachment, right? And if you know the name of this process, you know the name of the muscle that attaches here. Take a guess what muscle attaches here. The deltoid, right? Which is your shoulder muscle, right? Pretty big, powerful muscle. Deltoid muscle attaches to the humerus at the deltoid tuberosity, which is what? Mid-diaphysis on the humerus. All right, the distal epiphysis is part of your elbow joint. And it's a little bit complicated because your elbow is really amazing. It's pretty fascinating because it can bend, right? It can flex and extend. That's one thing that it can do. But if you raise your arm up and point your palm to the ceiling, which is anatomic position, right, because your thumb is lateral, put your palm facing the ceiling. Now, what can you do with the palm of your hand? You can twist. You're actually twisting at the elbow so that the palm of your hand faces inferiorly. So that motion is taking place all the way up over here at the elbow. So that's why this joint is a little bit complicated. There are two bones in the forearm, which we're going to look at in just a little bit. There's a radius and ulna, and they both attach at the elbow. So here are some smooth surfaces at the distal part of the humerus that attach to those two bones. So what do we call a raised smooth area? Not a raised rough area, but a raised smooth area on a bone. A condyle. So these are condyles, but since they're so special because you can do this motion, supination and pronation, with your hand, they're given special names. The one that looks like a marble right here is called the capitulum, and the one that looks like a little bobbin that you could wind some thread or thread on, that is called the trochlea, right? Capitulum and trochlea. And those attach to bones in the forearm. So you gotta definitely know these things. And a couple more things about this particular bone. Okay, so when I look at the deltoid tuberosity, can you describe to me what side of the bone is the deltoid tuberosity? It's not superior or inferior, right? It's right smack in the middle. It's mid-diaphysis. But where else, where could you tell me it's located when you look at the humerus right here? I like that. It's lateral. How on earth do you know that the deltoid tuberosity is lateral? There's a really nice landmark, and do you see the head? Here's the head of the humerus, right? The head of the humerus has to be pointing medially because it's going to attach to the rest of your body via the scapula, right? So here is the medial side of the humerus. Here is the lateral side. So now you know the capitulum is which way? Medial or lateral? The capitulum is lateral, and the trochlea is medial. And the way you know is just by looking at the bone. That's your answer key right there. Okay. And then there's some processes that are above the condylar surfaces. So we can see the lateral epicondyle and medial epicondyle. These are for muscle attachment. Right? And sometimes we can call these supracondylar eminences. So they can go by a number of different names. Well, one other little feature about this humerus right here. The head, which is nice and smooth because it articulates with the glenoid cavity, right, is what we call the head. Then there's a little bit of a narrowing, which I can see just as a slight little dark line right here. You'll be able to see it in lab. So what do we call a narrowing just distal to the head on a bone? And then the bone gets big again. That narrowing is what we call the neck, right? So here's the neck of the humerus, but it's still what? Very big. It's a very big part of the bone. It's very thick. And a humerus doesn't hardly ever fracture at this narrowing. When a humerus fractures on the proximal epiphysis, it likes to fracture about in this region distal to the tubercles, right? Because this is really much more narrow than this narrowing up over here by the head. So this is what we call the anatomic neck, right? Because it really is. It's between the head and the tubercles. It's a little narrowing. But this narrowing that is distal to the tubercles, this is what we call the surgical neck. So this is kind of a funny bone. It's got two necks. It's got an anatomic neck, which is very stable, and a surgical neck, which is a lot weaker, right? And surgical because if it breaks, you need that surgical intervention to put the bone back together again. All right, so this is a nice anterior look at the humerus. Here's a posterior look, and again, here is medial. I can see the anatomic neck right through here. Here is the surgical neck. The greater tubercle is up over here. Deltoid tuberosity now is lateral because here's the head. And I can see the epicondyles once again. And now I can't see the capitulum, right? Because that's only on the anterior side of the elbow, but I can still see a little bit of the trochlea sticking out right here. In lab, you're going to appreciate why this olecranon fossa is there. That's a prominent depression for holding something. If we look on the anterior side, there are a couple other fossa that hold something. Parts of the pieces of the bones that are in your forearm, right, which I'm going to have to show you, but it won't make any sense right now until after we look at some of the bones of the forearm. All right, so I'm going to pass by these. All right, so we're done with the humerus, looking at the forearm. How many bones do you see here in the forearm? Yeah, there are two. Right, and in anatomic position, these bones are parallel to each other, right, with your thumbs pointing laterally, and that's what I see right here on this little skeleton, right, the thumbs are pointing laterally. The bones are parallel to each other. The lateral bone is the radius. The medial bone is the ulna. And there is a ligament between them, the interosseous membrane, but it doesn't restrict the motion. It just stabilizes the forearm a little bit, but allows motion between these two bones, which is really important. Okay, so here is the two proximal epiphyses of the radius and the ulna. Here are the two distal epiphyses. Right? The head of the radius is proximal. The head of the ulna is down over here. The head of the ulna is distal. Right? So these things kind of fit together because of that very nicely. All right, so the radius, remember, you're just going to going to have to maybe memorize this until it becomes second nature to you. The radius is lateral. And maybe some of you can relate to this because there are times when we want to check to see if somebody's heart is beating. And actually, if we count the pulses in the wrist, we can actually measure a heart rate for people. Right? So you maybe measured your heart rate at some time by palpating this artery, right? Just right above your thumb. And your thumb is what, medial or lateral? Is lateral, right? So what bone goes right over through there? Lateral side. The lateral bone is the radius. So a lot of times, right, we'll take what we call the radial pulse. I don't know if anybody's ever used that term, right? Radial pulse, because the artery that goes right along the radius bone is called the radial artery, right? So it's a really nice artery to palpate. Really strong pulse going right through the radial pulse. All right, so it was named after that artery, which was named after this bone, the radial pulse. All right, so we've got radius and ulna. Here is the head of the radius, and we're going to see that it's circular. There's a little depression, right, for articulation. That's what articulates with the capitulum, right? The little marble on the distal end of the humerus fits right into the head of the radius, and this thing is going to look like a hook to you, and that hook is what fits into the trochlea. So one thing you're going to have to know is that the radius articulates with the capitulum, and the ulna articulates with the trochlea. All right, so let me look at another aspect. Here's a posterior view. This big bony prominence is what we call the olecranon process. All right, that's what the pointy end of your elbow sticking out right there, olecranon process. What's the function of that olecranon process? Muscle attachment. And a really important muscle that attaches there is your triceps, right? And so when you straighten your arm out like that, the triceps is pulling on this olecranon process. All right, here's the head of the radius. So here's medial ulna, lateral radius. Let me see what this next slide looks like. All right, so we're looking at the ulna, the medial bone. Here's your big thumb, your great thumb. Here's that hook I was talking about, the olecranon process. That's what you bang your elbow on all the time. Here is another process. That's the coronoid process, right? And that makes a little, what we call, trochlear notch. What fits into this trochlear notch on the ulna? The trochlea on the humerus, right? The thing that kind of looked like a little spool or bobbin. So this just snaps in really, really nicely. And when you straighten your elbow out, this electron process has to fit into a depression in the humerus, otherwise it would break off. And that depression in the humerus that accepts the olecranon process when you straighten your arm out, right, that point kind of disappears. Go ahead and straighten your arm out. Bend your elbow first, feel that point, the olecranon process right there. Then straighten your elbow out, and that process disappears. Do you see it kind of disappear? Now it's just kind of flat in that area. Where does it go? It goes into the olecranon fossa, the olecranon fossa. Okay, when you bend your elbow back in, then this coronary process has to fit someplace. And that fits into the ulnar notch. Let's take a look at those. Let's go back. Here we are. Okay. So here's the posterior side of the humerus. Here is the olecranon fossa. So remember, what fits into the olecranon fossa of the humerus? It is the olecranon process on the ulna. When you straighten your arm out, when you bend your arm, when you do a curl, right, then the head of the radius has to fit into, okay, the radial fossa, and then the coronoid process of the ulna has to fit into the coronoid fossa of the humerus right in here. Otherwise, these things would have to break off. That would not be good. All right, so that shows us a little bit about that elbow joint. Okay, a little bit complicated because you can twist the palms of your hands one way or the other. All right, well, we see that the radius and ulna join together. The head of the radius fits into this proximal part of the ulna, right, and the distal part of the radius, or let's tell you what, the head of the ulna, which is distal, fits into a little depression in the radius, and so there are little notches right here and right here. The notch on the radius is not named by the name of the bone that it's on, but it's named after the bone that articulates there, kind of like the way that we name processes in the skull. All right, so what is this depression in the head of the radius called? The head of the radius. Let's go back to the radius. Where is it? This is it. Let's go right here. All right, so here is the head of the radius. It has to fit into a notch in the ulna. And if we zoom in, here is that little notch in the ulna. It's going to be nice and smooth, right, to accept the head of the radius. What bone is this that we're looking at right here? That is the ulna. That depression where the radius touches it right here, right, is not called the ulnar notch. It's got to be called the radial notch because the name of the bone is the radius that articulates right here. Right. So that's this region. If we go down over here, we're going to see that on the radius, there is a notch where the head of the ulna fits into. What are we going to call that little notch that the head of the ulna fits into the radius? That's what we're going to call the ulnar notch. So where do we find the ulnar notch? Not on the ulna, but on the radius, right? So don't forget about that. There are a couple of little sharp processes coming off right here and right here that the styloid process might remind you of the styloid process a little bit. On the temporal bone. All right, so those are the bones of the forearm. That just leaves us with bones of the wrist, the hands, and the fingers. And this probably won't take us too long to look at. All right, so here is the thumb. Is the thumb medial or lateral, once again? Let's get oriented a little bit. Thumb is, and you always got to go to anatomic position. The thumb is lateral. Right, and so here is that lateral bone, right, because here's the thumb. What's the name of the lateral bone in your forearm? Once again, yeah, the radius, and then here's the ulna, which is the medial bone that lines up with your little finger. So I see a bunch of bones, just distal to the ulna and radius. These are wrist bones. These are bones that make up your wrist, and you can actually palpate with your index finger and your thumb your wrist bones. There are 8 of them. You don't have to know the names of all 8, but you have to know, as a group, what we call these bones. As a group, these are called carpals. Wrist bones are carpals, right? There's 8 of them. There's one that I want you to know, and that is the one that's right underneath the radius, Now look at the radius right here. Does it look long and narrow and kind of spindly, or thick and massive, would you say? Those are your two choices. Thin and narrow, or wide, thick and massive. Yeah, it's wide. Right, this end of the radius is a very strong part of the radius. Right, it doesn't break there very often compared to like the styloid process over here on the ulna. So when you trip and fall and you catch yourself with your hands, right, this radius jams right into these wrist bones or the carpals, and there's one particular carpal that's kind of narrow, right, and I see it right here. It has this little narrow region to it, and that's called the scaphoid. And it's a very typical kind of fracture. The scaphoid fractures when somebody falls, and they say you break your wrist. When somebody breaks their wrist, it's typically what bone, what carpal? It is typically the scaphoid, okay? So that's the only bone I want you to know in the wrist, is the scaphoid. But as a group, what do we call all of these right here? Carpals, yeah. And a scaphoid is a kind of carpal. The terrible thing about that is that when the scaphoid fractures, it breaks a blood vessel that goes into this bone. And what can you tell me about a bone? Is it living tissue, or is it kind of just sitting there like a piece of rock or concrete? It's a living tissue. Remember, it has osteocytes. And when blood supply is cut off to this bone, it dies, right? And those cells die. And since the osteocytes and osteoblasts die, then the bone doesn't heal. And as a matter of fact, it actually just likes to dissolve away. So after a break of the fracture, it's really difficult a lot of times to get the normal function of the wrist back, because what happens to the, what can you tell me about the structure of the wrist when the scaphoid dissolves away? The structure changes, right? If you take the scaphoid out, and when you change the structure of the wrist, what can you tell me about the function? It changes as well, right? And not in a good way. Okay, so these are carpals. The next bones, right past the wrist, what part of the common part of your anatomy is this right here? This is typically what we would call your hand. Right, here's your hand, so here's your wrist, here's your hand. Your hand has got five bones, right? And they're not called carpals, they are called metacarpals. So here are metacarpals. They don't have names, but they have numbers. And you gotta know the numbering system. It's really easy, it's really trivial, but it's really easy to forget as well. Right? Since your thumb is lateral, right, that's noteworthy, that is metacarpal number one. Index finger is number two. Little finger, right, which is the medial one, that's number five. These are all metacarpals. So one, two, three, four, five, and you probably want to say right or left, like if you're gonna write a report on somebody, because you have two hands. All right, so where do you find metacarpals? What part of your body? Just in layman's terms, they make up your hand. Okay, where do you find carpals? They're in your wrist in particular. Okay, well, what else do you have in your hand? Okay, you also have fingers, right? And those fingers are what we call digits. How many digits do you have on one hand? Yeah, you've got five. The smallest one is your thumb. And these we're going to give a number to. Number one, index finger, I see some bones. Right? Those are going to be number two. These individual bones, notice that in your index finger you have one, two, three bones. Each of those is a phalanx. As a group, they're called phalanges. Phalanges is plural. And we have to know which one is which. Here's the distal, the one farthest away from your body. So that's a distal phalanx. Here's a middle phalanx, and then the proximal, the one closest to your metacarpals. All right, but that doesn't describe this bone where I have the cursor right now completely. It's a middle phalanx, that's for sure, but that doesn't tell me exactly where it is. What else would you have to include in the name of this bone so you know exactly which one it is? Okay, the number. So here is number five. Middle phalanx, number four, number three, number two, middle phalanx. And then you probably also want to say right or left hand, right? Doesn't matter in this particular discussion. And here would be the number two proximal phalanx. And all of these together are the number two phalanges, Right, so phalanges make up a digit. So when I look at this index finger and I look at the little finger, how many phalanges do they have? How many phalanges? Another way is kind of misspeaking it. How many phalanxes? How many phalanges are in number 5, number 4, number 3, and number 2? I see distal, middle, and proximal. So there are 3, right? In digits 1 through 5. Now, how many do you see in digit number 1? I see a distal and a proximal, and that's it. There's no middle phalanx. And if you look at your hand, guess which one is the shortest? It is number 1, okay, because it's missing that middle. Now, would you want to call this phalanx right here where I have the cursor, it's number 3, all right? But would you want to call this the medial number 3 phalanx? Would you want to call this medial? There's a difference between middle and medial, right? Medial means toward midline. Middle means between something. So here is a middle phalanx because it's what? It's between the distal and proximal phalanx. All right, so don't say medial because it's really what? Middle. All right, so that's the upper appendage right there. And the lower appendage is going to be similar. All right, lower appendage. There is a girdle. Here is the pelvic girdle. I'll talk about this in lab probably starting maybe tomorrow a little bit. All right, so this is what makes up the pelvic girdle. This bone is called an ascoxae or a hip bone. Where does it say ascoxae on here? Ah, it doesn't say anywhere. What about the previous slide? Yeah, coxal bone or ascoxae, you could call it either one. All right, so it completely surrounds the pelvic cavity with the help of the sacrum. And if we take this pelvis apart, typically we call all these bones put together as a pelvis. And you'll be able to tell male from female pretty easily. Here is one of them. And when I look at this ascoxae, I hope you can see how many colors is it made up of. Can you see colors? Yeah, how many colors do you see? Yeah, 3. Do you see 3 colors right there? And that's because an ascoxae was actually 3 different bones that have fused together during development. And so these 3 different bones have got 3 different names. The one that's really superior, that makes your hip bone, that you can palpate, this is the ilium. The one that you're sitting on over here, this is what we sit on, this is the ischium. And the one in the front is called the pubis. So those are the 3 bones of an ascoxae. Ilium, which is superior, inferior and posterior is the ischium, and then anterior is the pubic bone. Oh, and look, here's a hole, right? And this is a foramen. This is what we call the obturator foramen. That's a passageway. Here's a notch. And I see another notch over here. These are what we call the sciatic notches. The big one is the greater sciatic notch. And the smaller one is the lesser. And you see something that separates the greater and lesser sciatic notches. What do you see separating them? It is the spine. And what color is the spine? It is, yeah, somebody tell me, somebody say green or pink. I don't know what color that is. But if you look over here, what bone is it on? It is on the ischium. And so this is what we call the ischial spine. And that's really nice because there's only one on the ischium. And that's a process, so that's for muscle attachment. Here's the ilium. I see a spine here, and here, and here, and here. And so this is the ilium. How many iliac spines are there? 1, 2, 3, 4. How many ischial spines are there? Only 1. Right? So it's easy to misname this ischial spine by calling it an iliac spine because most of the other spines are iliac spines, but not this one. Right? This is the ischial spine. All right, so the pubis I see right here. What side of the pelvic bone or ascoxae is the pubis? Where would you tell me to look for a pubic bone or the pubic region on an ascoxae? It's a little inferior, but there's a better way of recognizing it. This over here is anterior. Over here is posterior. Right, so the pubic bone is anterior. That's the bone right in the front. Right, so if we go up above to find the ilium, I see a spine here and spine here. These are anterior, so both of these are anterior iliac spines, but one is above the other. So here's the anterior superior iliac spine. Here's the anterior inferior iliac spine. The two on the back pretty much follow the same nomenclature. These are both posterior, and they're both on the ilium, so they're iliac spines. So here's the superior posterior iliac spine. Here is the posterior inferior iliac spine. And what's the function of all of these spines right here? You're just going to want to know muscle attachment, right, for these are just processes. And it really doesn't matter to me if this one here you call the superior posterior iliac spine or the posterior superior iliac spine, as long as you get all of those terms in there. It really doesn't matter. Okay, think back to the scapula. There was a depression that the head of the humerus fit into. Anybody remember what that depression on the scapula that the head of the humerus fits into? What was that called? It's called the glenoid fossa, glenoid cavity. Well, here is a depression. It's a very prominent deep depression on an adcoxae that the head of the femur fits into. Kind of similar to the glenoid cavity. This one right here, we don't call a fossa. It's so special, we call it the acetabulum. And if you have a real acetabulum, you can actually see these lines of fusion right within the acetabulum, right? So that you can actually see that there's actually three bones that make this up. Acetabulum. Acetabulum is very deep. The head of the femur is very prominent. It's a large head compared to the head on the humerus. It fits deeply into the acetabulum. And that is kind of important. Right, if there is a more significant fit of the head of the femur into the acetabulum, do you think that's a stronger joint or a weaker joint compared to the shoulder? If the head fits in deeper into the acetabulum, it's a stronger joint. That's right. The shoulder joint is a lot weaker, but that has some good features associated with it as well. Right, so the hip joint has to be stronger because it's holding up a lot more weight. Your arms really don't hold your weight up, so it's got to be a stronger joint, but the trade-off is that you have less dexterity. It's not as mobile as a shoulder joint, right? So you have lesser movement, but it's stronger. The shoulder joint is a lot weaker, but what's the advantage of having a weaker joint in the shoulder? Dexterity. You can move it around a whole lot more than you can with your hip joint. All right, so that's just what we call, a trade-off. Okay, so this is, now when we're looking at this bone, if this is the acetabulum, what side of the acetabulum are we looking at? Like what side of the scapula has the glenoid fossa? Is it medial or lateral? Glenoid fossa is lateral because that's where your arms attach, right? They don't attach like in the middle of your body. So what about the acetabulum? Same thing. Is it going to be medial or lateral? It's going to be lateral. So that's a nice, easy landmark to appreciate. Right? Acetabulum is lateral, which means then that we can look at the medial side. And I know this is the medial side of the acetabulum because I don't see an acetabulum there. I still see the three bones. Oh, it's a lot easier for me to see these colors now for some reason. I don't know what they are, but I can see them, but they're different. I can see the pubic bone, the ischium, greater and lesser sciatic notch, ischial spine. And what about that pubic bone? Is it anterior or posterior? Pubic bone right in the front, anterior. So here's the anterior superior iliac spine. Here's the posterior superior iliac spine. Right, so anterior, posterior. Then here is the inferior iliac spines on the anterior posterior side of the acetabulum. Now this is kind of a complicated bone. This one for sure you got to pick up, just disarticulate it and put it on your body. And it's not going to fit except for one way, and when it fits perfectly, you're going to know what the anterior side is, what the superior side is, what the inferior side is. That's really the only way I think that you'll be able to really know something about this acetabulum. To pick it up and put it on your body, you won't do that today, but because we're going to finish up axial skeleton in the lab today. But tomorrow, we'll start doing that. Here's that obturator foramen once again. This will be a quiz for you Not the one that's coming up, but the one after that, right? So the sacrum is a little complicated, and this one is a little bit complicated, so I'm giving you a quiz on two of the most complicated bones in lab, and so that just gets you started in a really good way to doing well on the lecture exam, right? And people usually do really well on lab quizzes, so if you can do it on a lab quiz, you can do it on a lecture exam and a practicum really easily as well. All right, so we get to stop right now. We're going to finish up the rest of the lower appendage on Tuesday, tomorrow. Okay, and we're going to start with the femur right over here. The femur is similar to the humerus in the upper appendage. It's going to have some very similar kinds of features. All right, so I'll see you in lab in about a half hour or so. Unless there's a question. Anybody have a question before we go? Don't forget, sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Please sign the sign-in sheet. Wow, somebody worked on, replaced all those lights up there. It's really nice and bright. Sorry, I didn't mean to scare anybody.